Coming up today, haunting artificial intelligence images, the rise of the Pirate Party, and we discuss Microsoft's latest hardware moves. You're listening to episode 291 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess, and joining me today is Victoria Wollison.
Hello.
And Ruby Lott-Lavinia.
Hello.
So on the back of last week's Wired Security, next week we've got Wired 2016, followed by our next generation conference. It's being held at Tobacco Dock. The main event is 2 days, and we've got the likes of Bertrand Picard, obviously from Solar Impulse. We've got Yves Rossi, the Jetpack Man. We've got some amazing surprise musical guests turning up. And then at Next Generation, we've got Heston Blumenthal coming down. We've got Luke Bannister, who is a 15-year-old drone racing champion. I mean, it just puts anything that we've ever achieved into perspective. If you are interested in tickets, you can buy them from wired.co.uk. Our events pages are on there, and you will also be able to follow the events on Facebook, on Twitter. We've got a Snapchat account for wired.uk for Next Generation. So try and get involved. If you can't come down to it, all of the coverage will be online, and you'll be able to watch all the videos of the speakers after the event the following week.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it here. It's a fantastic thing. We get some of the world's best speakers coming around. But Ruby, to switch things up, what have you learned this week?
Okay, so mine's quite terrifying and dystopian, which goes along with the fact that it's Halloween this week.
Topical.
Thank you, Vicky, for that soundtrack. So what I've learned is that China is introducing a dystopian ranking system called Sesame Credit, where you're rated for how good a citizen you are. It's co-run by a games company called Tencent that owns Riot Games. And it sort of came to light this week after there was a Black Mirror episode. It's the first episode from the new series called Nosedive, that kind of envisions this world where you're constantly rated for how popular you are. And how other people perceive you and your ability to access things like car rentals or flights is based on your rating, which is obviously horrible and terrifying. But it turns out that China is actually doing this. So their system dredges data from your social media streams. So if you share an article critiquing the government, then your score goes down. And if you share, like, you know, something from their sponsored news sites, then it goes up. It also takes data from your purchases. Currently, there's no consequences for having a low score, but there are benefits for having a high score, which is being able to get things like a loan quicker. And it's becoming mandatory in 2020, and you can also lose points for having low-scoring friends.
That sounds really dystopian and scary. It actually reminds me of the Community episode where they create Meow Meow Beans, which is a game where you rate all your friends. It's slightly different, but it's just like that ends in chaos and disruption and absolutely just everybody hating each other. So...
But can we just highlight again how on the money Black Mirror is?
I know,
that's
right?
That's what's scary, right?
Yeah.
It is just there. Everything is correct. And hopefully this Chinese system won't happen. We don't know.
It
sounds really...
introduced here. I mean, you're my friends. I'm definitely going to score low.
Yeah, I mean, the way politics is going, I feel like it's only inevitable. It'll happen in 2016, obviously.
Of course it will.
Vicky, have you learned something a bit more cheery this week?
No, I haven't. So last week I read out some extracts of Alan Partridge's book. This week I've picked up a book called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, and it's written by Matt Simon. So there's a marsupial, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, called Antechnus. So the males of the marsupial, they mate with every female they can find for 3 weeks straight until their hair falls out, they bleed internally, they go blind, and they die.
Oh, that is really depressing.
Good on them, I say.
Happy podcasting, everyone.
I've got one that isn't depressing. It's just very neutral. And I'm going to make you guess for this one, actually. So at the moment, one of the systems that underpins the internet is the IP protocol. So basically what domain names are, but the numbers and stuff behind them. And it's quite technical. So there's a new form that's coming in, and it has been coming in for a few years, which is called IPv6. It's replacing IPv4, which still runs a lot of stuff on the internet. But I want you to guess how many nodes there are. So basically connections and IP addresses that will be able to be created by this new system when it's fully rolled out. Anybody want to jump in there first?
I have no idea. I'm going to go really high and say 6 billion.
I will say 3.5 billion.
Well, Vicky, you win.
Yes.
But you're miles off. Absolutely nowhere near. So the current system at the moment has 4.2 trillion.
Oh, I knew we should have gone into the trillions.
So do you want to hear how many the full List has, yes. Or the new IPv6, and you've got to brace yourself for this one.
Okay.
340 undecillion, 282 decillion, 366 nonillion, 920 octillion, 938 septillion, 436 sextillion, 463 quintillion, 374 quadrillion, 607 trillion, 431 billion, 768 million, 221,456.
And those six, they're important. I mean, can I just change the thing I learned this week? The octillion is a number.
Yeah.
Is it? Did I pronounce that correctly?
I think you did. I don't know if I pronounced all those ones correctly. So.
I mean, I just never thought they were. I knew numbers were not that high, but I never actually knew what they were called. Anyway,
that is a number that seems beyond human conception.
It is. I haven't got a clue what a trillion
looks
like. Think of
all the memes.
Yeah.
You know, those IPv6 sites.
A Google is a number.
Yes. Yeah. It is indeed.
Couldn't tell you what number, but it is a big number.
But you can tell us something about the Pirate Party and their rise to prominence.
Lovely yeah. segue there into Matt.
Thank you very much, Matt. So it's really exciting. Basically, Iceland is known for its super radical political movements. But this week, the Pirate Party may be coming into power, or at least making up part of a coalition.
So it's the elections in Iceland this
week?
Yeah,
so on Saturday is the elections.
As soon as you say Pirate Party, I automatically think Monster Raving Loony Party.
Oh, I think of Pirate Bay.
Okay.
that I definitely have never used.
But the fact that they're really huge suggests that they're quite far away from
they have very radical values that I'll go into, but they are very much a prominent party and very popular in Iceland of recent. So essentially there's the Pirate Party's International, which spans lots of countries, and it's non-governmental, non-profit. It was formed in 2010. It campaigns for similar radical values such as direct democracy, governmental transparency, and public access to information. And then the cool thing is that the Icelandic branch was founded by a feminist MP, poet, and artist. Okay, I'm going to do my best like Icelandic Norwegian accent. Brigitte Jonsdottir in 2012. According to their website, the Pirate Parties are political incarnations of the freedom of expression movement, trying to achieve their goals by the means of establishment, the established political system rather than through activism. We focus on a new constitution, public resources, toll-free healthcare, participation in decision-making, and combating corruption. And amazingly, they've gone from winning just 5.1% of the vote in the 2013 parliamentary elections to gaining 40% at the height of popularity earlier this year.
So the party has just had a monumental rise. And I think some of this, as you're going to go into, is a little bit down to stuff that's come around the Panama Papers mm-hmm. and also lots of other stuff. But just basically, the party stands for a lot of, in a way, sort of liberal ideas that are very much open and very free and going forward. And basically, the internet is a great thing. Technology is a great thing. And they're set to do really well in this election in Iceland. So why are they doing so well in this one particular country?
I think in Iceland, there's three things. But firstly, there's the culture of radical politics in Iceland. It's so small. I think large groups of people wanting to create political movements can actually make a difference, and I think you can see that throughout Iceland. For example, this week, women in Iceland walked out of work to protest the pay gap at 2:38 p.m., which is the exact time women stop being paid compared to their male counterparts, which is really cool. And often things like that actually create obvious legislative change. So I think that, creates an attitude that political radicalism works, which chimes in with the ideology of the Pirate Party. Also, in 2015, the party's three members of parliament had their first victory involving the nation's laws. So they managed to convince other politicians that blasphemy shouldn't be illegal. Punishments for blasphemy were dropped. And since then, they've kind of gone up in popularity. Public outrage fueled its rise after the Icelandic Prime Minister, Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson, appeared in the Panama Papers after he was linked to having an offshore tax haven. And I think people got very angry about that, which fueled this kind of radical party.
I think the fact that if you live in a country where, a lot of people don't even vote, like in our country, because they don't feel like it's going to make a difference. They just think it's another name on a ballot. So the fact that you live in a country where you can really make a difference by just standing up and saying something is something that would be amazing. And when you read through some of the things they want transparency in government. Everyone does. No one wants to be lied to, but it's amazing how those ideals aren't really adopted anywhere else, or not to the same extent that this is. I mean, it's really captured their imagination, hasn't it?
Mm. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at the stuff we learned at Wired Security, and you can read all about that on our website, there was lots of information about the kind of divide between having, you know, transparency, but also having a government that can protect you from, I guess, increasing threats. And so it's getting that balance right. And I think that's why people are very kind of hostile or torn over the idea of how much transparency government should have a lot of the time. So essentially, the country goes to the polls on Saturday, and the party is predicted to be in a position to take control or form an alliance with another party. And analysts have predicted that the party could take 18 to 20 seats from a possible 63 and will field candidates in all constituencies.
Yeah, so it's not as certain that they're definitely going to get into power, but it looks like this is going to be a small movement that only started 6 years ago altogether, started in 2010, is going to actually become a leading party in a country and being able to control the government, which is something that is quite unheard of in modern politics, where we have incumbent parties that have been in charge for years and don't really change.
Well, that's what's interesting about the blasphemy law as well, is it's not that they've just been elected in, but they're actually a minority and no one's listening to them. They're pushing things through. They're making a difference already. So maybe if 2016 is not their year, maybe the next elections that come up, they might actually power through. And they could even then take the majority.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing a alarming swing to the right in lots of countries, but actually Iceland is one of those countries that is I guess dealing with financial struggles by moving to the left, which is really interesting.
It's a beautiful country as well.
It's very pretty.
So we'll see what happens with that result this weekend. If you haven't heard of the Pirate Party before, check them out. They are an interesting party. Even if you don't agree with what they believe in, they have a lot of values around technology and how surveillance and basically a lot of stuff in the digital age has come to fore. Obviously, there are other parties available and we're not endorsing them or anything like that, but they are just, it's a big change in political culture. And back here in the UK this week, Vodafone has been fined £4.6 million for mishandling customer complaints. Vicky and Ruby, have either of you two ever had any problems with, you don't have to name them, with your mobile phone companies at all?
My mobile phone company, Vodafone. And thankfully, I haven't. I've actually escaped. But I mean, what you're going to be talking about is pay-as-you-go customers, and I'm a monthly. So I don't think I've been affected by this. But I know friends of mine who can't get the signal, that not just on not Vodafone, but other network operators can't get signal. They get charged huge amounts of money. And as an example, my friend went into a shop at the weekend and he bought a contract for his phone and a contract for his iPad, two separate contracts that actually worked out cheaper per month than he was currently paying because he got missold something massively. And that's crazy.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of problems with it. Going through numerous instances of trying to get a new contract just show you how kind of difficult and wiggly it is to actually get something useful.
Yeah, it's something that a lot of us can relate to. So this fine from that hit Vodafone was from Ofcom, which is the communications regulator, was broken down into two separate areas, and there was two investigations that were going on. So there was a £3.7 million fine for taking pay-as-you-go customers' money and not actually really doing anything with it. So a number of pay-as-you-go customers, it was around 10,000, who basically hadn't used their accounts for quite a while, didn't have them deactivated, but then started reusing them again. And this was over a period from 2013 to 2015. And when they topped up credit, which is just strange that people are still on pay-as-you-go at the moment anyway, but that's
retro.
That's up to them. People have their reasons. When they topped up their money, it wasn't actually going into their accounts. They were just paying money to Vodafone and not getting a service.
But surely they would have complained straight away. Like if I put £10 on my phone and then I look on my balance and I've not got £10, I'd complain.
Yeah, well, they did. And that's part of the second part of the investigation, or the second separate investigation from Ofcom, was around complaints to Vodafone. And that was £925,000 they were fined for that, which combined, the two combined, come to the 4.6 million figure. And basically with this, Ofcom said that customer service staff members, agents they called them, weren't actually given sufficiently clear guidance on what was a complaint. So people working for Vodafone couldn't actually fully identify them, what was coming to them as being a complaint. And then they didn't know how to handle them properly either. They weren't telling customers that they had a right to take unresolved complaints to a third party after 8 weeks. And basically, the system around this was just not good.
But I don't understand how it got to the point where, how many people, 10,000 or something customers got to the point, surely after like maybe 1,000, and they got some complaints. They're like, do you know what, something might be wrong here. Like, what actually happened?
So how the situation arose was that Vodafone said the pay-as-you-go errors were down to computer problems, basically. So they moved
classic
yeah they moved a lot of customer details. They said about 28 million customer details from an old computer system. And this, within those 28 million customer details, they said there was around a billion actual entries, data entries, to a new system. And some of the stuff basically got lost, didn't come across properly, and really just there was a problem. And they said that there was multiple controls in place to reduce the risk of errors, but basically these people just got a bit lost in the ether and didn't really get moved across through the computer systems, which is obviously not really what you expect as a customer when something is happening and you don't even know that this sort of thing is changing.
I'm not on Vodafone, so thank God, but that would outrage me so much. So what are they doing about it exactly?
So it's the situation has actually been resolved now, or in theory it definitely should have been, but the fine should be the final point on this. But Vodafone said that there were failures and it apologised to these people that had lost their money, and they actually paid it all back to them. So there's about £150,000 that was paid back to these customers that didn't get stuff in. They said they've changed their complaint system, although BBC Radio 4 yesterday actually rang up their customer complaints line and were on hold for 42 minutes.
42 minutes?
Which, in fairness, might have been because this story had broken yesterday and there was a lot of extra people calling Vodafone. So that's not necessarily a complete reflection. But Vodafone say they've changed their systems. It deeply regrets any failures and it acknowledges it didn't do its best to meet its customer standards. And it's also paid a load of money to charity because it couldn't find 30 people. I don't know where they've gone, but it couldn't find 30 people.
Lost in the ether. They literally can't find
computers,
them.
Vicky. They're very confusing, you know.
So, it's paid a load of money to charity. And basically, the situation's over. Hopefully, they've learned from it. Hopefully, something like this isn't going to happen again. But Ofcom is looking into companies that are mobile companies and telecoms companies in particular don't handle complaints very well. And it's a big issue that they're doing. So I think this set a bit of example because it was one of the biggest fines ever around this area. So hopefully, touch wood, it won't happen again. From complaints to scary, scary faces. Vicky.
So
not your face.
Thanks. So while this podcast is available on iTunes, it's going to be Halloween. So can I get some scary... I mean, I did it for you guys. Come on.
Ooh.
Thanks. And so to coincide with this, obviously not deliberately, but obviously it all helps, is so the MIT Media Lab they've demonstrated just how terrifying AI and machine learning can be. Now, I know the likes of like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk have been saying for ages that they are going to take over humanity and they are the biggest threat that we face and stuff. And MIT have just basically shown exactly what this could look like. Now, I'm such a baby when it comes to horror films. I cannot watch them. I don't massively enjoy Halloween because people deliberately go out of their way to scare you and I'm not good with that. So I really did not enjoy this story. But I think you should definitely check it out on wired.co.uk. So they called it the Nightmare Machine. And it's basically an algorithm that's been trained to generate horrifying images. So at the moment, it's attempting to find the scariest faces and locations possible all over the world. And it's also getting humans to tell the computer which is more terrifying than another. So the first aspect is called haunted faces. So the team behind the project, they use deep learning to generate new faces before dropping what they call a hint of scariness onto the generated faces in the spirit of Halloween.
Hint.
A hint of scariest. There's no hint about how scary these pictures are. They're horrible.
Can you describe one of them to us, or can you try to describe one of them?
I will try. So the way that the machine learning does this is it merges some faces together, it adds some bloody eyes and some mouths, and then it sort of like has this distorted features. So it's sort of like a very modern day Picasso, but a lot more terrifying. So in order to improve the AI behind that, that's why they're asking people to say, is this more scary than this? And eventually they'll come across the most terrifying image. Now, I do realise for two podcasts in a week, we've talked about things that we're scared of. Maybe there's like a series in this. No, maybe there isn't. So once you've made your way through haunted faces, then there's haunted places. So the AI has learned how haunted houses and so-called toxic cities look. So they apply this style to sort of different landmarks all over the world. So they've imagined the Colosseum in Rome as a haunted house, which actually does look pretty terrifying. So they've made it all eerie and they've put clouds and stuff behind it. But they put the Louvre in Paris covered in flames. A bit horrific. What's quite nice about this is the Nightmare Machine sort of charts the history of Halloween and its links to AI, which you wouldn't necessarily assume. So during 1816's Year Without Summer, obviously the horror genre was born. You've got Mary Shelley, John William Polidori and Lord Byron. They locked themselves away in a mansion in Lake Geneva, and Frankenstein, the Vampire and Darkness were all written. Incidentally, years later, Lord Byron's daughter Ada Lovelace wrote the world's first machine algorithm for an early computing machine, cementing the connection between horror and machines forever.
I did not know that Ada Lovelace was the daughter of Lord Byron.
So the team at MIT, they're carrying out the project to see if machines can learn to scare us. I mean, I don't think it's necessary, is it, guys?
It's weird to bring up Black Mirror again, but episode 2 actually deals with a video game that kind of connects to your brain and learns how to scare you by kind of giving you an AR reality just through your eyes. It sounds quite similar to this, which is pretty terrifying.
I mean, obviously, this isn't the first time that AI has been used. I think we talked about it on a previous podcast. So IBM Watson was used to actually create a film trailer for the AI thriller Morgan. So in that instance, the computer was fed with more than 100 horror film trailers, processed the whole film, and came up with a suitably scary trailer. And it's actually pretty creepy. Like I say, though, I don't really like horror films. I cry at happy films, and I don't like horror.
I love horror films, but I have to say, I think there's a horror film within the idea of a computer creating a horror film. You know,
horror film Inception.
Basically.
So do you think this was scary? Did it achieve its goal?
Definitely. It'd be interesting to see what the ultimate scary face and the ultimate scary place looks like. Like, all the data that's fed into it, it'd be really interesting to see whether it comes out as horrific as my mind is imagining.
I guess it's like, is there a universal scary thing? Like, what makes things scary for all humans?
Well, there's all those studies that try and say this is the most attractive person's face, and it's based on loads of different people and the reasons why. Ruby is obviously the model for this.
Pointing to my face.
So it'd be really interesting, you're right, to see whether there is some, and it could be even an evolutionary thing, that there's something in particular that we're really terrified of in a certain face that's scary. And it goes back to what we were talking about phobias last week, about all the different evolutionary reasons why we don't like holes or why clowns scare us and things like that. So it's actually got wider implications. So although it seems like quite a silly thing for MIT to do, it is. I reckon it's going to have ramifications for all sorts of different things.
Definitely, and we'll follow their work as it goes on and see if there is any sort of conclusion to this, to see what is the scariest human face or what the scariest mashup of different images can be and created. But now we're going to move on to something that is important in a different way, and we're talking about Microsoft in a second. But first, we're saying goodbye to Victoria Wollaston.
Goodbye.
Coming up after the break, we're talking about Microsoft's latest products and its new lines of Surface Books and slightly different devices as well, and basically how the company has turned around.
This year, Wired launched the Wired Audi Innovation Awards to celebrate the people achieving extraordinary things, from AI to design and science to social innovation. The nominees have been decided, and the awards will be handed out at a ceremony on November 9th. To find out more, visit wired.co.uk. Search for the hashtag Wired Audi Awards and pick up the January issue of the magazine, where we'll be showcasing the work of the winners.
We've now been joined by Jeremy White, Wired's product editor.
Hello.
How's it going, Jeremy?
We have to explain why I'm laughing so much, actually. I can't just get that. It sounds like one of those fake media laughs.
Why are you laughing,
Hello,
Jeremy?
This is Jeremy. Hello. Hello, it's Jeremy here.
Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because you just cocked up the intro. And it's always funny to hear Burgess do that. It's Jeremy White. I'm the product editor of Wired, so I am joining you in the salubrious surroundings of our podcast room.
And you're joining us now to talk about Microsoft and basically the products that they've been releasing this week. Mm. So for people that don't know, and just to give a bit of context to this, Microsoft, it's the latest company. It's the time of year where companies are releasing their latest products and a lot of flagship lines. Google's done its Pixel phones recently. It did its VR headsets. Apple's done its iPhone 7 recently. They've got their MacBook Pro event tonight, which may be in the past now that you're actually listening to this, but that's coming out very soon. And there's just a lot of big releases. And Microsoft held a conference in New York yesterday where it released the latest upgrades to its Surface line, which are, what's the best way to describe them, Jeremy?
Well, I mean, you would describe them as their premium range. I mean, this is the top benchmark that they have for their sort of consumer technology products. And it's interesting, actually, that they're sort of duking it out with Apple. So you've got, you know, the day before and then the day after. So, that hasn't happened by coincidence. And if it's on behalf of, you know, what Microsoft have been doing, you know, it displays a level of confidence. And now we've seen the products, that actually makes a lot of sense. You know, they've had a tremendous amount of success with the Surface range, and their financial results reflect that as well. And I know you've written about that on the site too, but it's one of these areas of their product where you go, hang on a minute, they're really doing something interesting. And the what's good about it is that anybody can produce interesting and well-designed product. You know, not anybody, but anybody, a lot of companies manage to do it once and a few manage to do it twice. And when they start doing it more than that, then you really have to sit up and take notice. And companies go through cycles of design as well, whether they're able to actually produce consistently good design for long periods of time or not. And no company just goes on that, you know, lovely graph where it goes diagonally upwards from the bottom left to the top right. They, you know, there are always blips along the way, and there are always, you know, famine times and, you know, feast times as well for the industrial designers. And it looks like with this new range of Surface products, the Surface desktop PC as well, and also the Surface Dial, the controller, it looks like that Microsoft could well be in a period where they're producing some bloody good design work. I'm certainly really impressed with it.
Yeah, and you've mentioned the products there. We'll come into them in a second. Just to wind back, you mentioned that their financials the second ago. So it's actually also the time of year or every quarter where all the companies are releasing their financial details, how they've done in the last 3 months. And Microsoft have actually had a very good last 3 months. So the sales of their Surface devices across the whole range actually made $926 million, which is around £757 million, which was a big jump up from £549 million. So nearly, well, more than 200 million extra just on this one line. And overall, they had a very good quarter, but this was driving it. So this is something that is a really sort of important line. And for people that don't know, the Surfaces generally are a hybrid laptop, tablet, yeah, device or range of devices. And in the latest stuff that they've just announced was a big change. And you've mentioned it, the desktop. Mm. So can you just describe this and can you tell us a bit about this?
Well, the first thing to do to mention is this hybrid laptop with the Surface was actually, a lot of people have tried to do that from a design point of view, and a lot of people have failed. The Surface is one of the few examples where they really nailed it. You know, you could use it as both, and it was the hinge design was particularly familiar for those who remember when it came out. It's definitely caught your eye. It was a really, really good design solution to a design problem. And so here we have a desktop version where they are trying to marry, once again, for desktop PC users, they're trying to marry the experience of using a large tablet display, touchscreen tablet display, with the convenience and the power of actually having a desktop PC as well. So this PC has an extremely large screen,
28 inch
screen, and it tips down on its on a pivot axis where the housing underneath, like a footprint, a plinth that it stands on, then an arm comes up from that, and the screen is attached to that arm, and the whole thing can cantilever down to an almost flat point, and so you can work on the screen as if it's resting on the desk in front of you, or you can move that back and work as it as a natural PC, a standard desktop you normally would. Not only that, have they brought out a separate controller called the Surface Dial, which allows you to manipulate what's on the screen in a completely new way, which we haven't seen before. It seems to, you know, you can attach it to the screen itself and it acts as, say, a colour wheel or something like that, or a control to scroll around the screen. How exactly you can use it, you know, we haven't tried it yet. But if you watch the videos of the demonstration of it, you think, and it's one of those products where you immediately see and you go, you know it's good, because when you see products like that, you think, why hasn't someone done that before? And when you have that feeling, why hasn't someone done that before, you know it's a good product. Like when the tablet, when Apple brought out the tablet, the iPad, and you go, like, why hasn't someone done that before?
Speaking of Apple, you've mentioned the design of Microsoft. We've mentioned its rising stock success. Do you think we could see a future where Microsoft is overtaking Apple in the success of its hardware?
I think it would be silly for anybody to count that out entirely. You have to think back to how the dominance from decades ago, the dominance that Microsoft has in the hardware field, And it's very difficult for people to think that, especially if you've only been interested in consumer electronics for about the last sort of 15 years. But there was a time in living memory where they were, you know, Microsoft really did rule the roost and they had that dominance in there. And that what we should take from that is that nobody stays on top forever. You can stay on the top for a long time.
Capitalism.
You know? Yeah. You can stay on top for a long time, but no one really stays on top forever. There's always, you know, someone else coming in and some people trying to do it better. Now, I don't think for a moment that this means in a very short period of time that the success of Panos Panay and his team in Redmond, Washington, designing these Surface products, I don't think for a moment that the success they're having with that means that in a couple of years' time they'll be overtaking, you know, Apple's success. But it's this sort of consistency that you have to sit up and take notice of, and it's this that can be built on and then change a company's design fortunes looking further down the line. This sort of thing is changing. Those sorts of perceptions are like steering a tanker. They take decades to do that. But if you were at Microsoft, you know, 25 years ago, you know, you thought, or more, actually probably more than that, you know, you would have thought you were untouchable. And I'm sure there are people at Apple who feel the same way now.
Yeah, and like you've mentioned there, that this is quite a broad market as well. There's a lot of competitors in a lot of areas. Microsoft has also slightly strayed into a different area for them. We've talked a lot about the Microsoft HoloLens, their augmented mixed reality devices here. But yesterday, Ruby, they actually stepped into VR properly, didn't they?
Right. So they've talked a lot about introducing some untethered headsets, which would make a big difference to the experience of VR, actually, because one of the most irritating things about using VR is actually feeling like you are physically kind of limited in your movements. And that's something that's got to improve a lot. And from our experience of using, you know, the HTC Vive and the PlayStation VR, you can see on the Wired website, there's a lot of frustration on that front. But Microsoft are actually talking about introducing what is called 6 degrees of freedom sensors, which I think would make a big change to VR, because one of its issues is that you really feel kind of limited when you're using it.
Yeah, and they've actually partnered with Acer, Asus, Dell, HP, Lenovo to create a range of headsets that are going to go on sale from around $299, so pretty competitive and very cheap. They haven't really produced any yet or said that they've actually created some, but they're working on this and they've got a few prototype examples and things. So really they're branching out into a different area for them. They've seen that the HoloLens is maybe a bit too expensive, maybe not something that people want, but they're going to adopt some of their technologies into this. So overall, is this a red, not a red patch, but just a ruby glowing, fantastic period for Microsoft? Are they doing well?
I think they are doing well, and I think the point being is that you know we have to recognize why we feel, you know, there is an element of surprise there. So, oh look, aren't Microsoft doing well? Aren't these really good designs? You know, that that again is like referencing the fact that their designs previously have been pretty poor. There's something fresh about it. Something really good about it. Exactly right. I mean, if you look at the design of the PC, you know, it's a forged aluminium enclosure. There are no seams on it whatsoever. It's the thinnest LCD screen ever made, at 1.3 millimeters thick. And then in that, it makes a 12.5 millimeter touch screen, a desktop monitor. It's one of the thinnest desktop monitors out there. So it's tremendously well engineered, but also as a result of that, they've taken great pains to make it look as beautiful as they possibly can. Now, that is a legacy of where we are in terms of industrial design at the moment. It's like that not only does it have to look good, and it has to perform brilliantly as well. You only have to go back 5 years or more, and you had one or the other. You had products that looked amazing, and you had products that performed amazing. And then you rarely had the mixture of the two, which is why Apple managed to steal the march so much, is because they actually managed to join that together. It's taken so long for other companies to come back to the same conclusion that they not only have to perform brilliantly, and this does. You know, the screen is 13.5 million pixels on it. You know, it's big. It's much more powerful than 4K. It's a truly vibrant and brilliant screen. Not only do they have to perform amazingly, but they have to look stunning, jaw-dropping as well. I mean, You know, I'm reminded of Charles Eames, who said that, you know, that the details are not the detail. The details make the product. And God is in the details. And that's where these products are actually made to be, you know, transcend the category and make to be those sorts of things that you actually have to have. That want me factor. Got to have that. And when you see other companies, apart from Apple, making these sorts of design leaps and making the effort like this, it just makes my day. You know, we've been arguing for this sort of thing on Wired for years. Where is the better industrial design? It can't just be about how good the tech is. And here they are doing it, you know, finally, consistently as well. You can't just mention it after one, but they've made enough of these now in a row. You go, something's going on there, and we heartily approve.
Yeah, well, if you can't tell, we're obviously quite excited about what Microsoft's got coming out and coming up ahead. Are you excited? Are these the sort of things that are interesting you? Tweet us at wired.uk, or you can tweet us separately. You can tweet Jeremy at...
Jeremy Wired.
You can get Ruby on...
Ruby JLL.
And I'm at Matt Burgess 1. That's all for this week. Do let us know what you think of the new Microsoft products. Hopefully we'll see you all at Wired 2016 next week. And goodbye.